It's just Catherine. I'm not a doctor of anything. But I am a staff member at the West Virginia Prevention Research Center, which is housed within the School of Public Health and West Virginia University. And we'd like to speak a little bit today about our collaboration with our state health department and some of the achievements that we're proud of that have emerged as a result of that. And I have no relationships to disclose. A little bit about West Virginia. Many of you are from the Appalachian region, so we don't need to really describe where we're located. Some of our stats are what you might expect for our area. Our adult smoking prevalence is close to 24%, but in some of our southern coalfield areas, it can reach close to 40% tobacco use. We are 63% rural, and our state slogan is wild and wonderful. We're very proud of our wilderness areas. We want you to come visit us. We want you to spend your money there. I want you to spend them in smoke-free establishments. A little bit about our history. Since our very inception, our Prevention Research Center has collaborated very closely with our state health department, including on our initial application to the CDC for funding. And when the Master Tobacco Settlement occurred, that allowed the state health department's tobacco program grow from a very small group within epidemiology to its own division, which is now the Division of Tobacco Prevention. And when that happened, our role in the PRC also increased. We had been charged with evaluation since the beginning, but our role increased when the funding came in to get more involved on the ground floor of some of these projects and help the state health department ensure that projects that they were funding were aligned with CDC goals. And initially, it was very challenging because tobacco prevention grants were, they were given out in multitudes, very small grants of $5,000 to $10,000 each, dozens and dozens of them. Often they were awarded somewhat for political reasons, the same projects year after year, not a great deal of accountability. So initially, evaluation of those grants was very challenging. But the program restructured, as I mentioned, and the Division of Tobacco Prevention was established, and they aligned their services by three program areas: youth, cessation, and clean indoor air, which is what we're going to focus on today, which is using policy to reduce the burden of tobacco in West Virginia. And the state assigned program managers based on their expertise, and the PRC assigned evaluators to work with these program managers so that they could focus and specialize in particular areas. The CDC had advised state health departments to consider using a regional approach to carry out prevention services. And so what the state health department did is they looked at our whole state and they divided it into 10 regions and hired local prevention coordinators to carry out the work in these areas. And we were charged with helping out with the work plans for these regional coordinators. And here's what that looked like. And it was a pretty good model because when you use local people to carry out the prevention messages rather than sending people in from Charleston, trust is built up more quickly and they're seen as insiders and can often get more done. And what that did for us was to establish a consistent tobacco prevention cessation presence in all of the rural areas of the state. And our PRC covers all 55 counties of West Virginia. And a number of the people in these positions already had strong partnerships within the communities, and we were able to capitalize on that. So some of their duties, there were many, but the one that we're going to talk about most today is establishing and supporting coalitions to bring clean indoor air smoke-free policies to rural areas. Also to carry public education regarding secondhand smoke, cessation, and how the tobacco industry has targeted rural areas to keep them addicted, and also to promote the West Virginia Tobacco Quit Line. We're very proud that our Tobacco Quit Line serves all callers and not only provides counseling but free nicotine replacement. And so we've seen some definite progress there. And another piece that the regional coordinators work with is some creative counter-marketing. The core of their efforts is to take services exactly where people turn up. And for example, this photo is a hunting and fishing expo, a very large one, and there's someone carrying out a prevention message there. But also, we have cessation specialists go into the coal mines and some of these blue-collar industries. And so this is a direct cessation intervention being carried out in the break room of one of our larger coal mines. Now, probably everyone here has seen these mail pouch tobacco barns. The Block Brothers Tobacco Company was based in Wheeling, West Virginia, and there was a time when there were over 20,000 of these barn art displays in existence in over 22 states. And in West Virginia, our counter-marketing campaign has turned that on end. Instead of treat yourself to the best, treat yourself to health. And our regional coordinators are assisting with getting these erected throughout the state. And here's one that's dedicated to breast cancer prevention. And this was another creative campaign focusing on smokeless tobacco and encouraging parents not to pass that tradition on to their children. And our regional coordinators also get out into the school and support the RAISE program, which is our youth counter-marketing program. But what we'd like to talk about today is a partnership highlight in achieving clean indoor air at the local level. And in West Virginia, we do not have a state law that addresses where you can and cannot use tobacco or where you can and cannot smoke. And in our state, generally, these policies are carried out by local boards of health. And there's a huge evidence body that suggests why it's important to get these smoke-free policies in place in public areas. Comprehensive policies are policies that prohibit smoking in all workplaces and public spaces, including restaurants and bars and gaming. And in West Virginia, we have not so much big casinos, but we have a lot of small video lottery establishments, hundreds and hundreds of them actually. What we know is that when these comprehensive policies are in place in local communities, we know that heart attack rates decrease, more people quit as their options become more and more limited as to where they can smoke, and people who continue to smoke report that they smoke less. Youth are less likely to initiate using tobacco when it's not being modeled as a cultural norm everywhere they go. And we know that hospitality worker health improves, especially among women who have the majority of those waitressing and bartender jobs. And as education gets out regarding the health effects of secondhand smoke, we find that more people, even if they do continue smoking, choose to do so outside at their own homes in the interest of protecting their children and family members. And so we find that local laws are often more effective than state laws, and often they're a pathway for some states to get to a state law after there is a history of success at the local level. These laws can be enacted more quickly, and the enforcement structure is already in place within local boards of health through the inspection programs that they're already carrying out in establishments. And the local laws generally have greater community support because it was local people that asked for the protection in the first place. But most important, it is much harder for the tobacco industry to spread their power and their resources around to all of these little local communities. It's a lot easier for them to focus those efforts on the Capitol if you're going for a state law. And so we find that the opposition is less organized and less effective sometimes in these rural areas. And often the local laws are more protective. In West Virginia, a number of counties that passed comprehensive smoke-free laws are actually strengthening their regulations now to include e-cigarettes, for example, sometimes other tobacco products going into outdoor areas as well. This is a picture of where we are today with just restaurant and non-hospitality protection in West Virginia. So all of those yellow counties, they cover restaurants. They don't cover bars. The counties in gray still have smoking sections, and some of those counties in gray don't even have non-hospitality workplaces. In some of these counties, you can actually still smoke in grocery stores and offices. Now, when we look at comprehensive policies, and I just kind of like to quickly trace our history, that, and by comprehensive, these are the policies that cover restaurants, bars, and gaming. Started for West Virginia back in 2002 when little Lincoln County down in the southern coalfields passed our first comprehensive smoke-free regulation. And I would like to note that at the time, the adult smoking prevalence was 39%. And so it was an unlikely candidate, but they did it. And the health department did it in the interest of protecting their sanitarians that had to go out and inspect these places and didn't want them to continually be exposed to tobacco smoke. So we had got two counties back in 2002. And in 2007, by then, it had grown to eight counties. And you'll recall that was shortly after the release of the 2006 Surgeon General's report on secondhand smoke that was widely reported throughout the nation and the world. About you know, just how risky it was to be in the presence of somebody else's cigarette smoke. And by 2008, we got the entire mid-Ohio Valley. And I'd like to say that all of these regulations were passed as a result of our grassroots coalitions doing wonderful work and turning the tide. And that was true for about half of them, but a number of them were just passed by local health departments because they saw it as their job once that Surgeon General's report came out. And today we now have 24 counties with comprehensive regulation. That's about 45% of our citizens. Those stars that you see there in Monongalia County and Pocahontas County, there are actual municipal ordinances as well. We have one in Morgantown, West Virginia, and another one in Marlinton. And so in the event that any of these policies are rescinded, because that unfortunately does happen from time to time, one passes and then it gets taken away, then we'd at least still have the ordinances, hopefully. And some of the lessons that we've learned along the way, we'd like to share some of those with you. The first one being that every community is very different, and what works in Morgantown, West Virginia, may not work the same way down in the southern coalfields. But there are some great strengths to working in rural communities. One is that everybody knows everybody. And boards of health are typically staffed by just five people, and those five people are appointed by three county commissioners. In these rural areas, it's easy to, it presents a lot of opportunities for conversations because you're running into these public officials at ball games, at the grocery store, all kinds of events. And we also find that support exists in some non-conventional places, such as the faith community is one group that has really helped us get some great policies passed. And there just aren't as many bars concentrated in the rural areas. In our urban areas, you might have more than 100. In Randolph County, you might have just five or six, and so you're unlikely to see that well-funded opposition. And there's also a strong sense of personal loyalty in these rural communities. Sometimes a public official might be very open to passing something just because they had a personal relationship with the person that asked them, because they liked them. It's honestly the truth. Now, the challenges for the rural areas are also unique. You have the very high smoking prevalence, typically. And we also find that local politics really dominate these boards, and the same people sit on multiple boards. And boards of health are not typically in West Virginia staffed by people with any public health background whatsoever. They're often business owners, and that can be a real challenge. High presence of fraternal clubs, which some of those are beginning to want to cover their own establishments so that their people with asthma can get in and enjoy those places, but they're often a source of opposition. And often the coalitions They might have 10 or 20 people on them, but the work is typically carried out by two or three, and they get spread very thin, and they get tired, and sometimes it's easy to walk away when things start going badly. And we also find that boards of health sometimes don't understand well enough their own rules for conducting meetings, and that can get them in trouble down the road. And that same personal loyalty that might really help you get a regulation passed, if that personal loyalty is to a tavern owner, then that could honestly kill the entire thing, depending on the makeup of your Board of Health. And in West Virginia, we can't disregard our geography. And this is a nice relief map provided to us by Marshall's Herpetology Lab. And what it shows is not only our geographical challenges, because business owners and public officials are always concerned that if we pass a smoke-free law here, then all the business is going to migrate either across the state line or across the county line to a county that's got a weaker law. And so Ohio has a very strong protective law. Pennsylvania has a very weak one. Maryland has a very strong law, and Virginia and Kentucky don't have state laws, but they have a lot of local regulations like us. Pardon? Really? Tell me about it.
We're working very, very strong to have state laws. We have close to 20 municipalities across the state that have smoking bans.
Comprehensive, they're covering the bars and restaurants, and that's good news. That's going to help us. And also, we're challenged just by our simple topography. And those of you who live in mountainous areas know how local governments can just shut right down once the snow hits. And that key meeting that you needed to occur to get this to the next level just might not even happen in the winter. So. We've picked up some strategies along the way, some from the CDC and some from lessons that were hard fought over time. And one thing that we try to do at the PRC is learn what's working and what's not working in rural areas, and then to share that information and make sure that our community coordinators are talking with one another. But one thing that's really important is to conduct long-range planning and make sure that coalitions agree on the vision. Sometimes we find, and in particular with the faith-based community, they might be perfectly happy just covering restaurants because they don't actually go to bars, some of them. But we really encourage coalitions to push for getting that regulation right the first time and getting all of those workers protected, because typically once a Board of Health acts on smoking, they're not really going to want to see it come up again in two more years when, oh, you know what, we really would like to add bar and gaming to this because my grandmother likes to go to video lottery and, you know, she has asthma. So get it right the first time, look down the road. And also knowing the community is critical. What is the economic base of that community? What is the social structure? And use those strengths in your favor, and also find out who has the most influence in your community. It may not necessarily be a government official. You encourage people to ask everyone they know who they can talk to build that support. Most important of all is to promote the appointment of supportive policymakers to key positions. And so we ask our regional coordinators to make sure that their coalitions are aware of how these Board of Health members are appointed, to look ahead, when does this position come up, and to actually generate qualified candidates to apply for these positions so that it's not so easy for county commissioners to keep appointing the same bar owner year after year. When they have a slate of qualified candidates, it's a little more difficult to do that. And public presentations on the Surgeon General's report are fantastic, but we find that the most effective work is actually carried out one conversation at a time behind the scenes. It's really important that advocates are educated on the meeting rules better than those authorities that are governed by them, and that's the bylaws, public meeting notice requirements, Robert's Rules of Order. Because you can be sure that if there is an organized opposition, that they know all the rules, and they will use every single one of them against you. And so if you had an action that was passed and there wasn't enough notice requirement for a meeting, then that action is negated. And sometimes this has even reached the point of having Board of Health members removed and restaffed with bar owners for the sole purpose of rescinding great regulations that have been passed. So we can't emphasize that enough. And we actually have a technical resource person who's granted just to educate sanitarians and to educate public authorities on their own rules and to write good policy. Thank you. And we also encourage people to find ways for those quiet people to contribute. Just because somebody supports your smoke-free initiative doesn't mean that they're going to come to all the meetings and champion your cause. If you can get that person to have one conversation with one public official, then sometimes that will turn the whole tide. And just use every opportunity to educate, both formally and informally. This is a picture of a campaign, the I Smoke, You Smoke campaign, that focuses strictly on the health effects on pets, on cats and dogs, of smoking. And also, we encourage studying the opponent's playbook. Their arguments are typically very predictable, but it's important to be able to respond to those. And even after the regulation is passed, to remain vigilant, because the first thing that will happen is establishment owners may claim economic ruin, you know, within the first week of it being passed. And so just because it passed, sometimes you have to fight for years to keep them in place. We already mentioned our technical expert that is there to support the regional coordinators. And but one thing that she also does is provides mini grants to boards of health that pass these regulations, and those mini grants help them do after hours inspections in the evenings, because typically sanitarians only work till 4 or 5, and those grants help support those compliance efforts in the evening. And our role at the Prevention Research Center has been primarily to give the state health department guidance on evidence-based practice, and we take input from our community partnership board. But we also try to generate some local data and look at those trends and use those to build support in other communities. The CDC, if you haven't seen this guide on coalitions, provides excellent framework for strengthening community coalitions. A little bit about our local data. We found in our communities that just because heart attack rates went down in New York and everywhere else in the world, that this has been tested after a comprehensive regulation, doesn't mean that they're going to believe that that'll be the same thing here. And so we try to generate local data when we can. And one in particular is we have done some air quality monitoring, and this shows what air quality levels were like in establishments in one community before the comprehensive regulation went into effect, and they were almost all of them in the hazardous level on the EPA scale. And then after the regulation was passed, the air quality dropped to very good in nearly every establishment. And that really helps boards of health remain strong when that opposition comes after they've already done the right thing. We also collaborated with a county health department in Kanawha County, and over an 8-year time, even with a very weak regulation that only covered restaurants, we still saw a very significant decline in heart attack admissions, particularly among non-smokers. And so this local data carries a lot of weight with local boards of health. Some of the areas where we hope to go in the future are listed here. And so I hope that what you'll take away from this talk is that those partnerships between academic and practice community can result in policy changes that do improve health outcomes, as evidenced by our progress in clean indoor air. I'd just like to acknowledge some of the people that helped me gather some rural information for this talk. And there's our small staff at our PRC. And thank you.